But now back to the Coconut Grove and hurry, for the retiring president, Frank Capra, is turning the gathering over to the incoming president, producer Walter Wanger.
And now let's get right to it. The awards of 1939.
To Harold Arlen and E.Y. Harburg for the year's best song, Over the Rainbow. To Herbert Stothert for the best musical scoring, The Wizard of Oz.
This is Underscore, a podcast of music and story. Welcome back to Underscore, the show that celebrates the rich tradition of movie music one film at a time. I am Marty Brueggemann, and with me as always is my brother Will.
Last week on the podcast, we began our adventure into the land of Oz with the timeless classic Over the Rainbow. But today on the podcast, we're going to be focusing on the other prominent musical partner. We spent a lot of time discussing the songwriting styles of Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg. But today's episode is going to be focused entirely on the underscore of the film, and notably the music of Herbert Stothart.
Yeah, I believe we mentioned last week that Herbert Stothart is maybe one of the unsung heroes of The Wizard of Oz. If it wasn't already exciting enough to reflect on the marvelous music of Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg, we have to remind ourselves that The Wizard of Oz has one of the greatest underscores in the history of music as well.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. When you think of The Wizard of Oz, I think the first thing that comes to people's mind would be the songs. You know, we're off to see the wizard, follow the yellow brick road, somewhere over the rainbow. The list goes on and on and on. Yeah, you're right. I think even if this is a film that didn't have one single solitary song in it, it would be a movie that would be remembered for its music, because this underscore is not only something that's typical of the period, but it also goes so far above and beyond, I think, a lot of other films at the time. And I believe we mentioned this last week. It won the Oscar for Best Original Score in 1939. So it was something that was definitely even celebrated and appreciated at the time, the work of Herbert Stothart, which is, I think, if you haven't gone back and watched The Wizard of Oz in many years, or if you've never really taken a deep dive into the instrumental underscore, that's really what today's episode will be about. But it is quite exceptional.
Absolutely. Speaking of that Academy Award, Herbert Stothart in his career was actually nominated for the Academy Award for Best Score 12 times. Wizard was his only win. And actually, he lived to the year 1949. So who knows how many more nominations or awards he may have collected if that hadn't been the case. Just a little bit of background on Herbert Stothart, because his name tends not to come to the top of the list when talking about some of the greatest film composers in the tradition. Part of it may have to do with the era in which he worked, and I think another part of it, which we'll hopefully expose today, has to do with his approach to scoring in general, which is to service the film to a degree beyond even what we've covered on the podcast. We've mentioned many times how film composers, maybe uniquely compared to other composers, they're at the service of something other than themselves, right? So they're serving story, serving characters. Herbert Stothart, and this is especially true in Wizard, there's almost zero ego of any kind in his work. He's composing wonderful original motifs, but he's just as inclined to reference material from other composers, whether it be composers of the songs in one of his films or composers from classical music, folk music, whatever the case may be. But hopefully this episode can help to push back against Mr. Stothart's own humility and celebrate this great man.
You know, I think another really notable thing about the underscore to The Wizard of Oz is the variety of music that not only is referenced in a literal fashion in terms of quotations, and we'll talk about references to classical music or quotes of songs from the film, but really the variety in terms of mood, texture, style, and influence.
Right.
When I think of the opening music on Kansas, it's this sort of Americana, farm, pastoral, symphonic quality, and a lot of it is very youthful and innocent. We have these kind of agile woodwinds and just really delightful writing that definitely feels like it captures the period. Yet once we transform into the Technicolor world of Oz, the orchestration, I think, does become a bit more rich, and the influences from, you know, Stravinsky to Rachmaninoff to all manner of wonderful classical composers, Schumann and the like, the music becomes even more colorful. And also, you know, I mean, characterizing some of these incredible characters, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, the Wizard himself, the Wicked Witch of the West, Glinda, all these characters are depicted not only with the incredible songs that we associate with this film, but in some cases, their own really identifiable and catchy, for lack of a better word, motifs.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what you're saying about the transformation of the score as we move through the story of The Wizard of Oz. Of course, I think the change from sepia tone to technicolor is responsible for a large part of the changing landscape of the movie, but really all the departments are contributing to that just incredibly powerful transition from something like the world we live in to something just so fantastic. This colorful and rich and melodious land of Oz.
And I think if we're talking about the character of the score itself, it is definitely evident that this is the oldest score that we've listened to. It has some of the earmarks, harmonically, you could say, of the era, that influence of maybe more advanced jazz harmony meeting kind of the concert 20th century harmony that is just so evocative and of that period. That definitely plays a big part of the score of Wizard of Oz, but yet we also have the kind of comic side of the score, which I think is equally influenced by the vaudeville and Broadway traditions. To me, that's like epitomized in, you know, like the Hal Roach shorts, or you could even say some of the same kind of energy that we would get in early Disney cartoons or a Looney Tunes cartoon, both with the kind of classical referencing, but also the, we've mentioned this term before, Mickey Mousing, of right, using these dazzling orchestral musical effects to characterize specific on-screen beats. We have a bit more in that direction with the underscore of Wizard of Oz than we might in, say, like even a Star Wars, or definitely more so than a movie like Vertigo, or Back to the Future, for instance.
I think that's an excellent point. And there is just so much diversity when we take a broad view of Stothart's score. And Stothart really had such an incredibly well-rounded musical education and musical expertise. He had done some study in Europe, some study in his home state of Wisconsin at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And then in the 20s, he was working a lot in Broadway and came to Hollywood at the end of the 20s in 1929 when he signed his contract with MGM. And like you're saying, you're hearing that wonderful mix of influences in The Wizard of Oz, from the Stravinskian to the sort of Broadway soft shoe to the more progressive jazz and big band palette to the more 20th century American composition and that kind of pastoral Americana sound. It's really kind of staggering, the array of musical expression in the score.
I think that's absolutely true, Marty, and something that I don't think gets celebrated enough with composers of this period, of just how versatile they had to be. And the thing that I love about movies of this era is that for all the richness in them and the sophistication, you might say there's something comparable when we look at the quality of screenplays, maybe the depth of language or nuance of storytelling.
Yeah, almost the poetry of the dialogue.
Yeah, or I mean, we could literally talk about the poetry of lyric writing versus songs of today. When we talk about things like orchestration and sophistication of writing, that's definitely there. But I also think something that's not celebrated enough is just that versatility, that I think back then there was this almost unified culture. Everyone participated in some of the same things. You know, there weren't movies for little kids and then serious movies for adults. Everything was right, aiming for that sort of PG range. And so the thing about it is you had some of these incredible artists. The modern equivalent might be something like a Pixar film, where you have all these wonderful artists working together to create something meaningful and true and honest and artistic, but it's also appealing to all of these ages. And that wasn't kind of like a novel concept. That was more typical of the period. And I think that's one of the things that I love, is no one feels like they're using kid gloves. They're not kind of dumbing things down, so to speak, for the masses. But they are confined to a space where the references, maybe people don't understand them, but emotionally they need to kind of hit right down the center. So when you see The Wicked Witch of the West, you need to hear villainous music. Maybe people don't necessarily understand some of the classical precedent for some of the harmonies, but emotionally it can be immediate and direct. And I think just the craftsmanship of composers in the 1930s and 40s was the highest I think it ever has been in Hollywood.
And Stothart reminds me of the kind of educated, cosmopolitan, sophisticate of this time, who you wouldn't be surprised to hear quoting this verse of poem or play. And musically, he has this deep lexicon. Composers like Stothart, they're utilizing that lexicon in their work. Again, as we were mentioning at the top, it's really done with so little ego, so much so that I think it's almost difficult to relate to at times. Really, a significant part of the underscore for The Wizard of Oz is music that existed before the film. There's references that he's making to popular folk tunes, to classical music. Some of these references, as we'll get to in the episode, almost end up having a motivic function in the score.
Well, speaking of motives, I think now would be a really excellent time to examine some of the wonderful originally composed Stothart motivic devices. Some of these are more fully developed themes, and some of them are just a few brief notes that are so effective and are associated with characters or locations in the score. And I think some of this stuff will be immediately iconic to anybody listening, and some of it you may not even realize isn't some sort of transformation of song material, because Stothart does such a wonderful job of lifting up the Arlen melodies and using them fluidly throughout the score. But it seems sometimes that his ideas are almost developments of those ideas, or just picking up where Arlen left off. You talked about his humility, Marty, but I think it's just so evident in not just how fantastic this music is and clearly the craftsmanship that it takes, but also how seamlessly it fits into the fabric of the overall film.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. What I'm so grateful for is that the very first music that you hear in The Wizard of Oz is original music of Herbert Stothart's. It's that incredible Glinda theme. I love how it's positioned here, very unlike the character in which it accompanies. When she appears later on in the film, it's a very different musical setting, really emphasizing grace and a lot of gentle sounds in the orchestra. But here, right at the top of the film, this is proclaimed with so much bombast and heraldry, and it is just perfect. To talk about the incredibly unique outline of this tiny little jingle of a melody.
Yes, it's interesting because in some sense it's almost like a doorbell in the way that the Close Encounters idea is bum 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 bum. It's just these five notes. They're not a tune, but they're also so much more than just a sequence of several notes. They're almost like a serialistic tone row, yet they are so tonal. They clearly outline a key center. In the opening title, it's outlining the key of D flat, yet it is very chromatic. It's kind of this duality. There's this mystery to it, this definitely a sense of danger and an evocative quality, yet it's still within a tonal framework. It's not just kind of odd dissonance.
Well, and it reminds me sort
of
the harmonic language of the Romantic period, where if you are thinking of it in D flat, it's this really interesting harmonic pivot from a D flat triad to to a move outside of the key to almost an A major triad with the third in the bass. So we have that enharmonic equivalent of the C sharp to the D flat. It's a move you'll hear in Tchaikovsky, let's say, usually reserved for like the finale of a piece.
Right. We might think of that as that sort of flattened sixth major chord moment.
Exactly.
But yeah, this definitely has that 19th century classical flavor to it. The other thing that's so great about this Glinda motif, I feel like even more so than its tonal implications, to me, the big appeal to why I think Stothart chose these particular tones was the intervallic relationships between successive pitches.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Almost more so than the overall harmonic implications. It's just each one of those moves has a very specific emotional flavor, I guess you could say. And at the end, it almost has this diminished whole tone scale, Debussyan impressionistic quality.
Oh, absolutely. Ooh, I love that. And yeah, emphasizing the sixth degree, and we talked about those emphases of the sixth degree in major in the arrangement of Over the Rainbow last week. I'm totally with you. It does evoke some kind of tone row-ish quality to me because none of these six pitches are repetitions of note. It's just this beautiful, almost kind of dance of those intervals. And I could not imagine a more marvelous way to open this movie. We have been saying that it sort of evokes the Romantic period, but looking at the underlying harmony here, it's much more progressive than music of that time.
Yeah.
The opening chord that we hear before this melody takes off, this melody comes in on the and of one, it's this beautiful D-flat, what we'd call a 6-9 chord. So
yeah.
It has the sixth degree of the B-flat and the ninth degree of the E-flat.
Definitely a Broadway voicing.
Oh, completely. And we should say that implied harmonic turn halfway through this melody is not supported in the rest of the orchestra by any kind of harmonic change, which I just love.
Right. That's why I think it feels more 20th century and a bit more just a slight borrowing from the avant-garde school because of that dissonance. But it's also what characterizes the magic and wonder. We've talked before about borrowing from another mode, Lydian and Dorian, and the use of modal borrowing is a big part of maybe the wondrous sound of movie music. But I think just borrowed pitches in general, whether they're coming from another key or another scale, or they're just chromatic and wandering, there is something mystical about it. And I just love the danger that's conveyed in this piece. The other thing that's so effective is, like a lot of great film motifs, a more recent example would be John Williams' Kylo Ren theme. It has a specific rhythmic quality.
Yeah, great contrast of rhythm.
But it also functions as just those pitches.
Right. And again, sort of row-ish, where you don't have that repetition of tone. Yeah.
Right. With Glinda's theme, it could be like it is in the main title, where it's bombastic, but elegant and confident. Or the way that you almost first hear it introduced in the score as kind of this ostinato, this dizzying celeste and harp phrase, this just circular idea that's moving really quickly. That's the great thing about it, since it doesn't have those repeated tones, and it is so non-functional when you kind of repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. It's almost hypnotic.
Right, and I think that's important to mention, kind of the speed in which we hear it in the actual film when it supports Glinda. I wouldn't be surprised if a listener maybe doesn't even draw the connection between that and the opening fanfare of the film, simply just because of how different the orchestrational character is.
Right.
Also, Stothart so brilliantly moves out of that opening brass fanfare into that great string writing in the passage, just following.
Yeah.
And so it's hard not to have those two phrases connected in your mind. as though they're one theme.
Just to make the briefest aside, that whole main title medley is so fantastic. And I was mentioning this to Marty, that I think one of the things that's so fantastic about it is it's so filmic. It is a thing that happens in great Broadway overtures, where you have this incredible, elegant writing that weaves together some of the great songs in the film. But I feel like with The Wizard of Oz, it never abandons the mood of the film. A lot of Broadway overtures, they're kind of about fun. It's just kind of like there's points of them where there will be these dramatic shifts in mood that are almost humorous. And what I love about The Wizard of Oz is Stothart almost amps up the emotional caliber. For instance, when Glinda's come out, wherever you are, is hearkened to in this overture, it's this sort of unsettling Ravel Debussy kind of harmonic
sort of chilling.
Yeah, and I love that. I like how seriously he's taking it. And this gets back to the conversation we were saying last week about the difference between Broadway and film music, and I think Herbert Stothart completely exemplifies all of those differences in his underscore, in the way that he manipulates the other melodies and motives, as well, as his own.
I'm remembering our conversation on Back to the Future and how Alan Silvestri's great score is one of the major special effects of the film. I think it's what communicates the high adventure of the story and also kind of the high concept science fiction elements of the story as well. And this main title is doing all of those things here. It sounds like $1 million, even 80 years later. It is promising just what a lavish production this is. Looking at even just the instrumentation of that main title, it's sort of our full symphony orchestra, woodwinds, brass, and strings that we would expect, but it also has women's voices in the choir and piano and harp and celeste and bass drum and suspended cymbals and xylophone, and it's really a giant, massive sound. And if you ever have the fortune to experience The Wizard of Oz performed with live orchestra, which is something that is still scheduled in concert halls around the world, it's it's just stunning.
Yeah, I'm never going to forget just those first opening pitches of Glinda's theme being played by a real orchestra. It's that effect that you get in The Wizard of Oz going from sepia tone into full color. That was just magical. I think if we're talking about some of Stothart's original motives and themes, the very, very, very first thing that pops into my head is the theme of the witch, and more specifically, the theme that's introduced for Miss Gulch. And in the score, the track is Miss Gulch, the Ultimate Witch.
Of course, one of the great conceits of The Wizard of Oz as a film is that the characters that Dorothy encounters in Oz are portrayed by the same actors who play characters in Kansas. So Margaret Hamilton plays Miss Gulch, who is just this mean lady in the village, so mean that she's even cruel to the sweetest little movie dog ever, Toto. But yeah, I'm completely with you. When I think of Herbert Stothart's score, the witch's theme falls right into my mind. We have to talk about this ingenious little motif. We've mentioned across many of our episodes how the needs in cinema are quite unique and lead to interesting demands on a great film motif. One of them is it usually has to be able to work very quickly in a very small amount of notes and usually quite immediately. You know, we couldn't have sort of the hook of our melody at the very end of the phrase, so to speak, the way we can in a lot of popular songs or in a lot of other kinds of instrumental music. Oftentimes, a great film motif needs to be able to work in multiple levels. So the rhythm of the motif has to have its own hook. The pitches have to have their own appeal, and the harmony has to be also kind of immediately identifiable. All of that is happening here in the witch's theme.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that is so delightful about this theme is how circular it is, like Glinda's theme. I was kind of joking with Marty that I think if John Williams had composed this melody, it would go... and it would go down to D natural. But instead, it hits that sort of E flat or D sharp, which almost seems to emphasize like it's in the key of C minor. But the thing about it is that's what keeps it cyclical. That whenever you hear it, it's quite rarely just the opening few pitches. But the thing is, it totally could be because they're so iconic and memorable. But he seems to use it in this consistent way with this driving motor rhythm. I imagine it was very much inspired by the images of Miss Gulch riding on her bike and ultimately how that becomes kind of a parallel for the witch riding on her broomstick, that there's this propulsion, there's this energy in motion, both to the rhythm and the incessant kind of harmonic presentation of these marcato pairs of dissonant chord clusters. It's almost like this C major triad with also the minor third juxtaposed, or like the sharp ninth, essentially. So it's sort of like
so
a minor
chord. You can think of the melody
chord
as being maybe this minor melody that's emphasizing these upper and lower neighbors. But he's also established the major third at the bottom of the harmony really clearly. So there's just this great jar. And I feel like it kind of illustrates the character. It's almost as though you have this perfectly peaceful major tapestry and she is just puncturing it. And I'm totally with you. I wouldn't be surprised if he was inspired by Margaret Hamilton on the bicycle. There's something about those rhythms, those dotted eighths with the 16ths. That's another thing we see in a lot of great film music, is there's some kind of asymmetry built into the phrase that lends itself to continued repetition. It's almost like
you almost think of the wheels of a bike, you know, bouncing over little rivets in the road. But you know, it has that effect to it. The other thing, that chord construction of the sort of C major sharp nine chord, that really dissonant minor majory sound, it definitely makes me think of John Williams. In fact, there's a certain moment, I don't know why I'm referencing The Force Awakens so much, but I think you'll know the moment I'm talking about when Rey is in the forest. I think that I have the moment correct, but I think it's when she looks up and sees maybe the TIE fighters. There's this little moment where almost essentially that chord voices. I think it's in a different key transpose, but essentially we have like the third, fifth, and then the sharp ninth. And whenever I hear that sound, it makes me think of John Williams specifically, but really just the language of film music and cinema and the kinds of dissonance that we almost have been trained to expect in the context of a movie. And these are things that we would never accept in the context of like a popular song. But there's nothing more bright and technicolor and for all ages than The Wizard of Oz. But look under the hood, we see some of these really dissonant and advanced orchestral chord constructions.
Advanced orchestral techniques.
I had to do it.
There's just no shortage of advanced orchestral techniques in Herbert Stothart's underscore, which is part of why I'm so thrilled that it gets to live on in these live concerts and in the wonderful publication, which we mentioned in the last episode, recently released by Omni Music Publishing. And boy, this is a treasure. Christmas came early this year. Do get your hands on it if you have any interest in composition, orchestration, music theory, or just a fan of Stothart and this film. Another thing that I just love about the witch's motif is how frequently it appears in the film. And often when it's reappearing, Stothart seems to be having so much fun with reinterpreting it with a very different orchestration and sometimes different harmonization as well. I really have to imagine that the score for The Wizard of Oz was an influence on any budding musician of a certain age. And really, the movie is so timeless, it will hopefully continue to influence budding film composers. But we really get some wonderful, slow, fanfaric statements of the witch's theme when she kind of surprises us with re-entering in the film.
And one of the great touches of Stothart is he has these character-specific motives, but he's also so deft at weaving in the Arlen song material that's also associated with those characters. A great example that I'd like to point out comes from when Dorothy first meets the character Professor Marvel, who ultimately is performed by the same actor as, and is almost implied to be, the Wizard of Oz. there's this little Arabic idea played in a solo oboe that has this harmonic minor quality with that augmented second. It's very typical of the period, kind of characterizing this.
But again, a very catchy little tune.
Very much so. But in that portion of the film, he's also juxtaposing it with the song The Merry Old Land of Oz, which we're not introduced to until much, much later in the film. But it's this subtle detail like this that makes this movie so rewarding to go back and listen to. It's probably one of those things that I doubt anybody notices, but it's so helpful and so focused on serving the story that I imagine, even if it's on a subconscious level, it does plant the seed that just blooms into something special at the end when you see Professor Marvel becoming the wizard, almost as though, you know, you'd heard about it in a dream.
Right. That's one of the great abilities of a good underscore, is that it's able to work on this quasi-subliminal level on us as we're watching the film. We've been talking about Stothart's work as lacking ego. Another great way of looking at the score is it's just this beautiful team effort. The songs continue to shine across the entire movie. His original score ideas shine across the entire score. And there are, of course, these wonderfully applicable musical references whenever it's appropriate, and whether that's cued by a line of dialogue, let's say, or maybe a song that's reminiscent of some other classical piece or something like that.
Yeah, that's so true. It feels like he has a sensitivity to the pitches themselves and almost has so much fun developing these ideas and creating new themes out of the song melodies and referencing the song melodies and finding, like you mentioned, classical themes that have similar pitches to the song melodies. And it all creates this wonderful, you know, kind of dreamlike porridge where all these things are interacting together. But if you listen to almost any cue in this soundtrack, you will just be delighted to hear so much referencing to either classical music, some of his own motifs, the Arlen songs, and usually multiple songs. I mean, The Wizard of Oz has a lot of song material in it. And some of the songs, I mean, you think that whole Munchkinland sequence, it's almost comprised of like 12 different little songs, you know? And so there's so much melodic richness for Stothart to tap into, and he just makes every conceivable use of it he can.
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing ever seems to be left off the table. Another one of our favorite original Stothart motifs appears once we've traveled into the land of Technicolor Oz. And it's one that reoccurs as Dorothy's on her yellow brick road journey. We first hear it in a cue titled The Cornfield. This is just before she encounters her first new traveling companion and great friend, the Scarecrow. I just love this little motif. For Will and I, this is very reminiscent of We Were Shields music for the Hal Roach shorts. But I love how it's scored here for maybe a more sophisticated orchestra, and it's set to solo oboe instead of saxophones or something.
Well, and I feel like he's really picking up from the counter melody from the song, whether it's I've Only Got a Brain, I've Only Got a Heart, you know, they all utilize that same melody. We'll talk more about that next week, but there's this little responsatory phrase that I'm sure everyone's familiar with, usually played in a recorder. And so he almost picks that idea up from
and
there.
And uses it as foreshadowing.
And yeah, and again, all this stuff is foreshadowing. So much of the referencing to the song material comes before you actually hear the songs. It's really kind of ingenious.
And we didn't mention it, but as it turns out, Stothart himself revealed this in an interview during his lifetime, that he kind of regarded the witch's motif as a variation of We're Off to See the Wizard. And if you speak that rhythm to yourself and picture the pitches of the witch's theme, you might be in for a little shock. I know I had never drawn that connection until seeing that little interview segment.
Well, the other great thing about the witch's theme is it sounds taunting. It sounds like something that like little children. Yeah, it's very much na 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 na. You know, it has that kind of feeling to it. But yeah, the rhythms do sort of come from We're Off to See the Wizard. But again, in this cue, The Cornfield, Stothart is making reference to that song as well as Follow the Yellow Brick Road. And it's just like, the great thing about Arlen's songs is they're so immediately identifiable. None of them start the same.
Right.
You can hear the first five notes and you know what song that is. Same with Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Bum, 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 ba-da-dum, bum. Even if you just have time to get that phrase in, you've got it. Or da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, you got it. You don't need any more.
What's amazing is that Arlen's songs are kind of emblematic of what we're talking about with great film motifs. There's a wonderful variety of rhythms in each of the kind of opening gambits of all of these songs. Whether all of this was conscious or not, the song material just works so wonderfully as film music motifs. And you have to imagine Stothard and Arlen feeling so fortunate that they had the opportunity for this kind of musical collaboration.
Again, this is where the idea of him being such a humble composer and such a servant of the material is so evident, because his musical material owes so much to the songs, but also the specific classical reference points seem to wink or reference the songs as well. There's that wonderful bit of the Schumann, that happy farmer, that's used throughout the score. It's almost like the theme of Dorothy in Kansas.
Right.
It's something that a lot of people probably don't know comes from a pre-existing piece of classical music, but it just coincidentally enough, and I don't think it's a coincidence, opens very similarly to Glinda's song come out wherever you are, and plays off of those same opening pitches.
Which is one of the last phrases that he quotes in the opening main title.
Right.
As soon as we come out of that main title, then we hear the Schumann excerpt. I think it's like you're saying, it's as though Stothard is so sensitive musically that that's triggering this memory for him of the Schumann. And it happens to perfectly kind of illustrate Kansas for Dorothy.
Well, and another great example of that is the just glorious, you know, Firebird Stravinskian Oz March, which almost completely seems to be developing the Merry Old Land of Oz theme again. Bum-bum-bum, bum-bum-bum, couple of la-dee-das. That thing gets sort of transformed into this wonderful march.
It shares a lot of the same contour and rhythm, but yeah, it's a wonderful whittle tune and definitely one of the highlights of the score.
Yeah, and it also characterizes sort of the pompous nature of the guard. And
right.
I love the depiction just in the film of Oz, that it's like, this is the whole point of the quest, and you get there and it's kind of like, I don't like this place.
Yeah, it's weighed down by bureaucracy.
Yeah, and it's this kind of commentary on how ineffectual maybe government is, or ineffectual our society is. The whole song talks about sort of how lazy they are. We get up at 12 and start to work at 1, take an hour for lunch, and then at 2 we're done. So essentially doing no work. It's very much, to me, almost an allegory about growing up and realizing that you kind of have to take responsibility for the things in your life.
Yeah, Dorothy is hoping that some kind of adult is going to be able to help make sense of all of this.
And I think Stothard's orchestration choices, when we first are introduced to this march, very much communicates it, because harmonically, I don't know, again, to me, his use of some of these dense, like, pantonal clusters, it reminds me of that wonderful moment towards the end of the Firebird.
Maybe my favorite Stravinsky moment. So beautiful.
There's this satirical element to how it's characterized. It's kind of wimpy and pathetic at the same time, too, with the first way that we're presented with it. That there's something comic about it.
Yeah, as we've already said, Stothard is just so prepared to illustrate Dorothy's journey as she's moving from these very different locations. And I think for a fan of a more forward, melodic-driven film score, there's kind of nothing better than that sort of opportunity. It's almost like a Super Mario game or something. Okay, now we're in the icy world. Now we're in the tropical jungle world. You have beautiful, very different in character music to accompany all of those beats.
Well, and there's something about Stothard's orchestration and writing that seems like it's characterizing the glistening design of Emerald City. This is a very bright, almost strident piece, and all the tones, yeah, muted trumpet and piccolo, and it's almost on the verge of being shrill. And there's something about that that feels so like picture specific, yeah, to the images.
Again, really helping to sell the special effect here. Most of the shots we see of Emerald City are thanks to a great matte painting. And I think it is beautiful, but really without this music, I don't think it comes to life.
There's so many delightful moments in this score that we could literally spend, you know, four whole episodes just dissecting the Stothart material. But unfortunately, that's not what we intend to do. But we can't conclude this episode without discussing some of our favorite moments. We've touched on a lot of the motifs that we wanted to recognize, but there are some entire cues in this film that are just so staggeringly well written and so iconic for every little detail and nuance of them that we just need to talk about them. One would be the delightful music during the entire Twister cyclone sequence of the movie.
Yeah, it's just a tour de force. I believe we alluded to it in our last episode that it's just a great example of timeless action scoring. Kind of unbelievable to think that this was worked on in 1938 and 39. It's so harmonically daring, and we move from so many sections that are very different in character. I think he strikes a wonderful balance of accompanying on-screen action, maybe more in the Mickey Mousing style like we're talking about, but he also allows for musical phrases to kind of complete things on their own terms. This would also just work as a concert piece. And as a concert piece, I think it would be quite avant-garde, actually.
Oh, very much so. One of the things that I love so much about it are the unique orchestrational touches, one of the best of which I think being the vibraphone with the fans on. I mean, it's to me almost foreshadowing the dreamlike state of Oz, and what ultimately, spoiler alert, gets implied in the story is, was this whole thing all a dream? Dorothy hit her head during all of the stuff with the tornado. There's like a little foreshadowing of that, but there's something also threatening and menacing about the wind-like nature of the fans on the vibraphone that characterize the gusts, and you get that in the strings in the orchestra and also the brass. And I totally agree, Marty, this does strike a great balance of scoring the on-screen material, but also characterizing the sound of a tornado and a twister and that momentum and that things get sucked up and blow around and then are out of sight. And the other thing that I so love is, yeah, the film's in sepia tone, but I feel like were it in color in that instance, it wouldn't look much different, because right, the color during the middle of a storm, especially when there's a tornado, it has that kind of uncanny, creepy, alien, greenish, grayish glow to everything. And it's almost the color of a sepia tone film, which is, I think, one of the brilliant choices of shooting that whole sequence that way. And a lot of people think The Wizard of Oz starts in black and white, but it doesn't. It's that kind of yellowy gray, which to me is just so perfect for depicting a tornado.
Yeah, there's almost a soil quality to the sepia tone that I think is just perfect. The other thing I love about this cue, and it really is the cue that transitions us from the two worlds of the film, the more grounded Kansas. The real world is the one that's more monochromatic and lacking in life and color. And then the other world of Oz, of course. I think part of what really sells the transition is just how intense and virtuosic this music is. I have to believe at some level you're taking in the incredible performance of all of these musicians.
Yes.
And the sort of nonstop runs and the woodwinds and the strings and the incredible loud playing and all of the brass, you're kind of exhausted by the end of this cue. You're sympathetic, yeah, to maybe the sweat and the work of all those musicians, and you believe that you've gone through something.
Well, and the deft change of tone, musical and emotional tone. Once Dorothy's right in the house and it's wrapped up in the cyclone, we start realizing that, is this real? Because she starts seeing images of things going by that seem difficult to believe. What I think looks like Auntie M waving at her, it's very bizarre. And his music does a great job of kind of striking that this is just a lovely film moment. This is fun. This right is like the moment in a Broadway show when we'd have a big dance number. And this is probably, I feel like this might be the cue that won Stothart the Oscar, because this is the cue that he weaves together almost all of the musical material that we've heard in the film so far. We hear the witch's theme, Mrs. Gulch theme. We hear that happy farmer, the Schumann idea. And we hear all this new material for the cyclone. And then we also hear that other theme. That's another kind of motive.
That may be a quote of Reuben and Rachel.
All just characterizes what we've already seen in the film and what's familiar to Dorothy. And the great thing is, just in a story way, everything that Dorothy sees in that cyclone basically tells you her struggle in life. It shows you her friends, her family, her home life, and also her basically enemy at this point, the person causing conflict in her life. And all of those characters sort of illuminate themselves throughout the rest of the film in a different quasi-metaphorical way. And what's so great is that those classical quotes, those motives that are associated to characters back on Kansas, once they actually get developed as songs, now they take on this other connotation of the Land of Oz. And then throughout the rest of the score, he tends not to use the happy farmer and that Rachel and Reuben theme, and instead uses the Arlen material. And it's kind of that's another thing that characterizes this great transition.
One of my favorite stretches of film music ever is that move from the cyclone cue and then to this incredible pregnant pause as Dorothy steps into Oz, and then the very next cue, Munchkin Land. Musically, they couldn't be more different. It's such a contrast in orchestrational texture and musical mood.
And it's disturbing and beautiful all at the same time.
Absolutely. I love the way he chooses to paint Oz and in just a few moments paint Glinda. As you're saying, it's this combination of stunning beauty with something almost alien and haunting. The extended harmonic palette here is just so gorgeous. And like we said, all of the musicians really just gave their all in that last cue. You're sort of fine with leaving Kansas behind and leaving that palette behind for the time being.
And the other thing is the way that Stothart references Somewhere Over the Rainbow and that material throughout the rest of the film. It kind of comments on it in a way that, is this really what you wanted, Dorothy? Because when you think about her character, the whole time she's on Kansas, she wants to leave. She wants to be anywhere but there. But from this minute she lands in Oz, she's only trying to get back home. That's the other thing that I think is interesting. It doesn't take the whole movie for her to realize that. The second she's in Oz, she's like, I need to go back home.
Right. Yeah, and I love how the film gets to have it both ways. You're so excited about being in Oz and marveling at the Technicolor and everything. But your sympathies, I think, still lie with Dorothy, and you want her safely at home, if that's what she's saying. I think that quote of Over the Rainbow, which is really the first melodic phrase you hear when the score kicks back in, is so important, helping to connect the dots with the audience. This is what she's dreaming about. I love what you're saying. The harmony underneath maybe kind of questions that in some way.
And I think that's just a truism of life. Is when sometimes when you have a specific wish or a dream based on one situation in your life, to get what that is literally is often not exactly what you would want. I mean, there's that great story, The Monkey's Paw, where the whole conceit is that when you literally get the wish you ask for, it sometimes can be quite disturbing and isn't actually at all what you want. And I think there's something about that that is at the center of almost the moral of The Wizard of Oz. Not to say that you shouldn't have dreams, but The Wizard of Oz is more of a story about appreciating what you already have and looking at your situation and empowering yourself. That's the thing that's so fantastic about it. You know, it has this great I Want song, but also its ethic is about accepting who you are and embracing your own community and everything. But it also, Dorothy learns how to sort of take charge, and she makes the change. She is the active participant in her own destiny. She's driving the plot forward.
Yeah, completely. I think it just speaks to the timelessness of the film. So many values that we're trying to put to the fore in films and television now are already here in 1939, like you're saying. This incredibly strong heroine is driving the story and does have her destiny in her own hands.
That being said, our incredibly strong heroine does get captured by flying monkeys, of all things, and finds herself trapped in the castle of the Wicked Witch of the West. And in one of my favorite scenes of the film, she has to be rescued by her friends, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Lion. And the music throughout the entire sequence of the Witch's Castle and Dorothy's subsequent rescue is also some of the most iconic in the film. And it also has an added pressure, because as we mentioned last week, there is no song moment in the final act of the film.
As I believe we said, there was intended to be a reprise of Over the Rainbow, which I think kind of speaks to some of the themes you were just talking about. The longing that she's expressing in that song towards the beginning of the film, we might assume that refers to this fantastic land of Oz, but it's still actually a sentiment she can cling to when she's in Oz. It can represent wanting to return home or reaching for some life that's better than what she's experienced.
Someday I'll wake and rub my eyes, and in that land beyond the skies, you'll find me.
I think that also speaks to the incredible power of that song as this timeless anthem, as we hopefully illustrated last week. Barring that moment, it's, you know, not in the final cut of the film. Like you said, there is a different kind of pressure on the score to really help highlight and maybe even drive some of the action here. The stretch of the film involving the Witch's Castle also has a couple of prominent classical quotes. There's almost a verbatim quote from Mussorgsky's Bald Mountain. There's also a Mendelssohn quote from his Opus 16, number 2, inside of The Witch's Castle.
Well, it also has a Germanic quality. It reminds me a lot of the music of Berlioz.
Oh, sure.
And that kind of era of romantic music where it's characterizing, storytelling, tone poem, kind of a style to The Witch's Castle, which I think is appropriate for the images.
Completely. But we can't talk about this part of the movie without highlighting maybe one of the most iconic moments of Stothart's underscore. And it's one of his more prominent vocal-led moments. This is the March of the Winkies.
This is probably one of the most iconic things from the whole movie, and I just know almost every kid loves to march around and sing this song. But it's interesting, there isn't a soundtrack release that has the singing in it, and I don't understand maybe if that was something that was just assembled in the final mix, but I mean, that melody is so iconic to it, the OEO, but also all of the rhythmic and harmonic devices in this, the ba 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 da 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 da
da da da da da da da da.
Yeah.
And what's great is each of those ideas seems reserved for a particular choir of the orchestra.
Right.
There's that woodwind phrase, and then there's those great brass chords. Mm-hmm. I love the clustery texture of those chords.
Yeah, it's sort of this grotesque march. It has this unsettling quality. You're watching these barbaric alien creatures, and it ends up being really fun in the movie, but just the music and the way it's commenting on it. And there's something kind of satanic and devilish almost. There is that sense in this march almost as characterizing witchcraft and the evils of that I think is kind of neat.
I mean, we talked about the witch's theme as maybe having this kind of playground, teasing quality, but this is just one of the purest melodies. It's highlighting this open fifth, up and down with the OEO. I can imagine kids singing this, pretending that they're marching castle soldiers.
This whole reel of the film musically reminds me of the Tchaikovsky ballet Sleeping Beauty and the kind of music that he composed for the witch in that story.
Dun, 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 dun. Oh, so great.
A similar kind of balletic medieval commentary on witchcraft and evil. And one of the great things about Stothard is you can tell he's so learned. And in addition to the quotations of specific things, you mentioned The Night on Bald Mountain, the Mussorgsky and Schumann, there are those influences from whether it's Russian composers or German composers or French composers. I mean, we've only scratched the surface, but that's the great thing about film music is there's kind of this American thing. You know, you have Chinese food and Indian food and Mexican food and burgers and whatever, and it's just all together. That's like what American film music is, because you have a lot of these people were European immigrants, but there's this freedom in film, since you are serving this other element, to you borrow a little from this for a quiet scene, and you borrow a little bit of this for a militaristic scene, and you borrow a little bit of that for a love scene, and that's just kind of the fun of movie music, I think.
Right, and it's like a moment that might almost be evocative of Petrushka or something, and then another moment that might quote an American folk song. Home Sweet Home, I think that's a very familiar tune. Kind of reminds us of that great Laurel and Hardy short, Saps at Sea.
Play the horn,
play the Stan. But there's another tune, In the Shade of the Old Apple Tree, that pops up. Not surprisingly, when we're among apple trees. Again, Stothard is just so musically sensitive and almost can't help but referencing these things. I think kind of similar approach to what Carl Stalling and others did in scoring the Mirror Melodies and Looney Tunes shorts. For a lot of kids that grew up with that material, that was maybe some of our first exposure to some of these classical and folk melodies.
Yeah, I think the last thing that I would really want to mention about Stothard's score is his use of orchestration to characterize images and emotion. I mean, it's something that I think every film composer does, but is so poignant in this era. I mean, one of my favorite moments in the score, actually, and in the movie, when they first approach Oz, and you have, we mentioned last week, that kind of green hologram and the pyrotechnic smoke and everything. But there's this delightful cue that has these declamatory brass statements and this such a frightened little, you know, tremolo strings. And the contrast of those shows, this is the might of Oz, or at least what we think, and these are the scared, cowering, you know, heroes. It's beautiful, simple, elegant orchestrational touches like that that totally characterize the entire experience of Wizard of Oz, that this is delightful music that's really, really rich and interesting to listen to on its own. But not only is it married to the images because we've seen it, it's so composed to those images that it tells the entire story of the movie, even if you're not looking at them.
I couldn't agree more. And in the same way that the image itself is utilizing the entire available color spectrum, or what was available with the three-strip Technicolor, and how Harold Rawson's cinematography really highlights the change of location and environment, Stothard is using the entire range of timbre and pitch in the orchestra. And yeah, those, I think he even calls them smoke chords in the score when they approach that haunting holographic image of Oz, highlighting the bottom of the orchestra. It has such impact, and boy, Stothard's score is just this well-balanced meal from beginning to end. He almost always seems to have a sense of what needs to contrast what in terms of moment to moment and musical idea to musical idea.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today as we celebrate the incredibly rich underscore of composer Herbert Stothart, an equal partner to Arlen and Harburg, in my estimation, to the overall sonic palette and just the magical movie experience of The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, this is a score that we could re-listen to and re-experience again and again, and really, it's not just that we would never tire of it, but I think we would continue to find new jewels and gems there.
I hope you'll stick with us for the rest of this month as we examine the rest of the songs to The Wizard of Oz and, of course, have our feature-length audio commentary where we put all of this analysis together in our viewing of the complete film. And what a complete film this is.
And in case we haven't explained it thus far, we've decided that our approach to movie musicals will by necessity have to be somewhat different than our approach to films thus far.
Because there isn't necessarily a spotting session in a musical film, because so much of the music, half of it, has to be created before the shooting even begins. And so there isn't the same demands as a typical film. So next week, rather than having a spotting session episode, we'll be having an episode where we discuss the rest of the Arlen and Harburg songs as we put together the narrative structure of The Wizard of Oz.
And I cannot wait. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate and leave a review at Apple Podcasts, which helps new listeners discover Underscore.
As always, you can find us on all manner of social media, Facebook, YouTube. You can find every episode of this show, as well as some of our fun supplemental materials, at underscorepodcast.com. If you have a comment or question or something that you'd like to share with us, you can send us an email at the_show@gmail.com. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter at __show.
The second underscore is silent.
That's all for this week, everybody.
And remember, we listen because we love. Take care. Our show is made possible thanks to our generous patrons, including Jean-David Blanc, Travis Anderson, Richard Welch, Jackie Brueggemann, Josh Lucan, Charlie McCarran, Kevin Wang, Carlos, Alex Steff, Benji Inniger, Desmond Clark, BJ Crawford, Simon Parker, and David Liu. Thank you so much for your support and for listening. Underscore is part of the Marcato Brothers Podcast Network.